Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the British Library in London for a live recording of What's Your Map, presented by Professor Jerry Broughton.
Beneath our feet in the basement of the building in which we're sitting, there are approximately 4.5 million maps. They're stored and preserved in a subterranean network of stacks, safe from fire, flood and thieves, online and offline. Sheet maps, atlases, globes, maritime charts, town views. From the 11th century Tiberius world map to the latest digital mapping of our towns and cities, the British Library has them all. I'm Jerry Broughton, and welcome to What's Your Map, an Oculi Mundi exploration. In this series, we hear from those who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and tell us the story that lies behind it. What makes the podcast special is that listeners are able to follow and look at high-definition images of the maps on oculi-mundi.com. And today, I'm joined by an audience of map lovers at the British Library. Yay! And with me is a man who spends almost as much time unearthing neglected maps and trawling through archives as he does hiking and climbing mountains. He's a geographer, an author, a broadcaster, and the former president of the Royal Geographical Society. His books include Clear Waters Rising, A Mountain Walk Across Europe, 2 Degrees West, An English Journey, and the best biography I've certainly read of the 16th century map maker who we're going to be hearing more of in a moment, Gerard Mercator. You'll also know him as the waterproof wearing, umbrella wielding or cycling presenter of the landmark BBC series Coast. Please welcome Nicholas Crane. Okay, Nick, I get to ask you, what is the map that you're going to show us today?
Well, it's quite a secret map. I've just finished researching and writing a history of British footpaths. In fact, it's called A Secret History of British Footpaths. I did a lot of the research here in this building. One of the maps I came across really stopped me in my tracks, literally, and it's the one we're looking at now. And it describes one of the most significant military land grabs ever to have taken place in the British Isles. Now, the military have very good reasons for land grabbing, and we're going to come on to this in a moment. What this shows is Salisbury Plain, which at the time was the, as it still is actually, the largest area of unfenced chalk grassland in northwestern Europe. Now, the reason it mattered to the military is that they were looking for somewhere that they could conduct military manoeuvres, artillery, regiments of foot soldiers, and cavalry. And, of course, if you have a military land grab, it basically means turfing the public out. And that was my interest. So what happened after this map was drawn? What happened to all those footpaths and drove roads and trackways that crisscrossed Salisbury Plain? They're actually marked on this map. It's at a scale of 3/4 of an inch to the mile, so it's very detailed. That's detailed. So it's nearly as detailed as the old, do you remember the 1 inch to the mile Ordnance Survey maps? Nearly as detailed as that. So you can see individual farms, you can see individual trackways, stone hinges on there. Salisbury, the city of Salisbury, divided the north of the map. It's a very detailed map indeed.
Tell me first, I guess, who made the map. So tell me about James Wilde, because I know a bit about Wilde, but Wilde is quite a wild character, but you've found out more about Wilde.
You know, when you're writing books, your heart just leaps with joy when you come across an eccentric operator. James Wilde was phenomenally successful as a map maker. One of his specialities was making maps, making money out of maps of places that didn't yet exist, you know, which is kind of a wonderful achievement. So he would anticipate a saleable map, draw it, and then hope that the market would develop. So, for example, he would publish maps of new railway lines before the railway line had been built. The comic magazine Punch, during his lifetime, ran a cartoon showing a James Wilde map hanging at the North Pole. Now, this is before anybody had been to the North Pole, which gives you an idea of how he was treated. His output was phenomenal. I mean, he must have been up there night making maps. And they covered everything. He had a particular interest in military hotspots. So he did maps of Crimea. He did threatened parts of America. And so this particular map is very much the kind of thing he was specialising in.
So what's going on at that moment? So this is 1872. I mean, is he jumping on that point around what's going on militarily and what's going on in Salisbury Plain? Why is he so interested in mapping this area?
Yeah, so 1872 is a kind of turning point in British history. So for centuries, France has been the big enemy. But very abruptly, there's a unified German Empire being created just before this map was drawn. And the German army march into Paris. A few years before Wilde drew this map, Palmerston completed his chain of 72 formidable forts in southern Britain. And some of you may have heard of this, the fictional story, The Battle of Dorking. The story was published the year before Wilde drew this map. Has anyone read Robert Harris's book, Fatherland? So the Battle of Dorking was a very similar kind of thing. It's a story written anonymously about an unnamed foreign power storming the beaches of Worthing and Brighton and charging up towards London to take London. They're confronted by desperate rearguard actions on the North Downs around the Dorking Gap, where the main road goes between the coast and London. And there's a final showdown in this story between the Surrey Volunteers and the invading army at Surbiton Railway Station. Now, believe it or not, this, just as Fatherland was a bestseller, the Battle of Dorking became a bestseller. And so you hadn't just got politicians getting anxious about this rising German superpower, but the public were completely freaking out. The Battle of Dorking was a deeply alarming story. It was a bestseller. And when it emerged, eventually the author was tracked down, and he was a serving general in the army called Chesney. So he got a massive ticking off from Gladstone in Parliament. But by then, in a sense, the damage had been done. The public were only too aware that Britain was under threat, really serious threat. So the urgency to train the army to fight a desperate rearguard action against invading forces became so great that effectively they took over Salisbury Plain, and a Manoeuvres Act was passed in 1872. Characteristically, James Wilde produced this map 2 days before the Act was passed in Parliament, which is just, you know, I thought, so how did he get the information?
And is there a sense in which he thinks he's got a public, therefore, are going to kind of gobble this up because it's picking on this moment of real national insecurity?
Do you know, Jerry, if I was going to write a whole book about James Wilde, which of course would be deeply interesting, I'd probably find out. But I don't think this map was for public consumption. So what we're looking at here, if you look at the scrutinised, can you see the big pink line running around all the margins of the map? That is the area within which the Military Manoeuvres Act operated. So within that area, the army were allowed to do what they wanted.
These are the camps.
Those are the camps. So there are 37 orange blobs, all numbered. But if you look at the copy of this map in the archives here in the BL, those colours are hand-painted. So it's basically a monochrome black and white engraved map, but somebody has engraved over the top of it these critical forms. Here's part of the pink border of the training area. The training area is drawn very much like the British colonial powers used to demarcate overseas countries. Mm. It's quite random. So this particular bit here, Jerry's just highlighted, follows a Roman road. Up in the north of the area, it follows a railway line. Then there's another section that just goes as if they've just laid a ruler across the downs and just drawn a straight line. It makes absolutely no acknowledgement that the people living around the edges of Salisbury Plain might have a life, you know, that they had to go out to tend their animals in the fields or bring their flocks back down to the farm. So within this area, the army would pay compensation to any livestock killed or fences broken. There were very few fences. And right across the middle of the map, Wilde has written the entire area of Salisbury Plain is unfenced. Now, that was for military consumption. So I think the map did two things. It was a graphic representation of the Manoeuvres Act that passed through Parliament. because there was no map attached to the act, as far as I can make out. At the end of the act, there's a paragraph called a schedule that describes in written language where this pink line should run, but there was no map with the act. So I think what Wilde did was produce this map, probably for the war gamers, for the generals who were going to take over the plain with their cavalry and artillery and infantry.
And do we know what happened with those manoeuvres? Are there any accounts of... I mean, it must have been chaos.
It was unbelievable. Fortunately, there's a simply fantastic record left by Private Collier, who came from Southampton. He'd never. This is at a time when people didn't travel. So, you know, humble people like Collier, who worked for a baker in Southampton, he'd never been to Salisbury Plain. It was his first time. So for him, it was like a foreign land. He couldn't believe the beautiful white cottages with thatched roofs. And then... The battles were huge. The current standing British army is about 70,000 personnel. They put 30,000 on the plain at one go, so half the current size of British army were out there. They divided the 30,000 into two armies of 15,000. There was an army defending Britain, the Northern Army. There was an army invading Britain, the Southern Army, and they all had a white band round their shakos on there to distinguish the two opposing forces. And they literally fought a pitched battle. So there's a lovely little pretty village now, some of you may know, East Codford, lovely little place. Collier left an account of basically the entire churchyard and surrounding cottages wreathed in cannon smoke and cavalry charging through the village. And of course, you know, people, you know, there were injuries, you know, and Collier, the troops weren't fed properly. There were huge problems with water supply. So now the Military Maneuvers Act, as described by Wilde, just basically describes the area of the plain where the army were going to be allowed legally to play their games. What happened almost immediately after 1872, after these maneuvers, they were so successful in the military terms that the army bought the plain bit by bit. So, you know, so the MOD, as you may know, now own an area of England, Britain the size of Surrey. But this is where it all started.
Let's talk about, because you've told me about, you have some sort of skin in this game on this map. Tell me about your own personal connection to it.
So this is a slightly eccentric little episode in my life. In 1997, I'd become very enthused by the work of two landscape artists, Richard Long and Hamish Fulton, both of whom conduct kind of artistic walks on the landscape. I went to see Richard. So I've got this idea, I'm a geographer, I would like to write a book about England objectively, so I'm not following the River Thames or following a coast or following the footsteps of Thomas Hardy. I want to follow a geographical transect, a dead straight line from the top to the bottom of England, and I'll limit myself to describing the people and places on that straight line. Richard thought it was a great idea. The issue for me was, how am I going to follow a straight line? Well, as it happens, and I think we're going to come to it in a moment, Britain is mapped on something called the Mercator projection, which relies on lines of longitude to anchor itself to the 3D globe. And the central meridian of Britain runs right the way down the middle of England, and it is the only line of longitude that is mapped by the Ordnance Survey. So I followed 2 degrees west down the middle of England, and it runs right down the middle of this map. Now, for reasons that will become apparent in a moment, there are no lines of meridians, lines of longitude, on Wilde's map. Mainly because there were 37 different projections, actually no, over 50 different projections being used in Britain at the time. So different counties, everybody mapped their own county on a different projection so that the jigsaw wouldn't fit together. Half of Wilde's map is in Dorset and half of it is in Wiltshire, so there's no way he's going to marry the two up. So he hasn't got any lines of longitude on these. So 2 degrees west actually runs right down the middle of this map. West Lavington, where Jerry's pointing to, is where I met the army because I had to get permission from the MOD to walk over Salisbury Plain in a straight line. There was a battle going on at the time. There were tanks and jets and bangs and crashes. So the MOD thought it was a great, great wheeze. And so half a dozen army officers met me and we walked in an eight figure. They told me to come to this grid reference and we walked in a dead straight line for the entire day over the plain while all the bangs and crashes were going on each side of us. It was one of the most extraordinary experiences, actually, on that walk.
I should say, I met Nick after I'd read the book, and I thought, this guy's mad. This guy's absolutely mad. There's a bit where you go, I can't remember, you're going through, you have to go down a motorway, and you go through, you go through the sewer. And I'm going, this guy, the commitment to this going 2 degrees west was quite something. It's a wonderful book, if anybody wants to read it. And it takes us, Nick, to a wonderful story of a connection. You mentioned Mercator. Many people will know this Mercator map of the world from 1569. This is the famous Mercator projection. Some of you may know about it. And I was thrilled when you wanted to make the connection between Salisbury Payn and James Wilde and Mercator. What is that connection? Just tell us what that is.
Well, we're going to scroll back 500 years to the beginning of mathematical map making. That's the connection. The Ordnance Survey are mathematical map makers, but the man who started it, who made the huge conceptual jump from pictorial map making with monsters and sailing ships sailing oceans, normally on woodblock maps, to incredibly accurate mathematical map making on copper plate engravings, which allowed far greater detail, was the man who did this was, as Jerry's mentioned, Gerard Mercator. Born in the Low Countries in 1512. He was, if I had to sum him up with a single word, I'd say he was a harmonizer. Spiritually, he existed in the Danish mid-ground between the Lutherans and the Roman Catholics, which is why he got locked up by the Spanish Inquisition. But in the meantime, he went on to produce the most important works of map-making in the 16th century. And this particular map we've got here is his most misunderstood and his most enduring. If you look at it carefully, you'll see that right down at the bottom, where you'd normally expect to see the landmass of Antarctica, you can see Antarctica stretching from margin to margin. If you look towards the north, you'll see that North America is absolutely massive from side to side, and so is Greenland. So people looking at this map at the time thought, and he was very famous by the time he produced it, thought he'd completely lost his marbles, because the people who had the greatest grasp of what the world looked like in terms of land masses in proportion to each other, people who owned globes, which were hugely expensive. So everybody knew a globe as a 3D mathematical model of the actual world. Now, the problem was, how do you flatten that 3D model into an accurate 2D map without distortion? Well, effectively, you can't. It's impossible to do it. You will always have distortion. What Mercator wanted to do was accept there'll be distortion, but allow compass bearings to be the same whether you laid your compass on your flat map or stood on the deck of a ship using it.
Hence this sort of spidery lines, these lines
yeah,
here.
The loxodromes. Really, yeah,
yeah, the loxodromes, yeah. Which absolutely cover the map. It's like a sort of spider's web. Yeah. So not only do we see that north and south poles are projected to infinity, but you have these endless lines. Because the map, the translation from the Latin, is it's for use in navigation. Okay, so it's not, you know, an objective world map. Nick and I could sit here for hours talking about this map, hours. But yeah, sorry, go on, because that's an important aspect, obviously, about how you navigate from one point to the other.
I've got to be honest, Jerry, I want to hear you talking about it. No. Jerry is absolutely brilliant on this. I feel carry on, Jerry. I'm enjoying it.
Well, we could talk about the way in which what I find so interesting about it is that, because what you have is a map which projects the north and the south to infinity, I think this is why north ends up as the prime direction in all Western maps, because, and Nick has written very well about this, nobody wants to go up here. So what you do is you create a situation where you lengthen the way in which these parallels work, the further north and south you go, which is why you get them projected to absolute infinity. But across east to west, they're much more accurate. Mm. And what do you know? There's lots of ships, because it's showing you this is for seaborne navigation east to west. So it's a map which puts north at the top, because nobody wants to go there. That's why north ends up at the top.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a brilliant, brilliant projection, which acknowledges, as Nick says, why it is partial. And all this text, look, he says, look, this map is partial because it's for use in navigation. And you've got to sacrifice something, which is the mapping of the north and the south. And he even shows that's the North Pole down there.
Yeah.
But what I want you to also then talk about, Nick, is how do you get from that? Mercator then does something really interesting, because not only does he do that projection, but in 1595, under his name, comes out the first atlas. And look how it maps Anglia, England. So take us from how Mercator is mapping the world to how he's mapping England back to Salisbury Plain.
Yeah, so we're still in the 1500s, end of the 1500s, and what we're looking at here is one of 16 maps in this book, this bound book of maps that Mercator called Atlas. He was the first person to call a bound volume of maps an atlas. There are 107 of what he called modern maps in the atlas, covering the whole world. Now, the critical thing is that he portrayed all these maps within the famous Atlas of 1595 at three levels of detail. What he's trying to do, I'm sure, he never actually says this anyway, but what I think he's trying to do is replicate in two dimensions the benefits of a 3D globe. He understands that when we look at a globe, we want to zoom in. You know, we might see it on the far side of the room looking like, in its mount, a spinning a galactic orb. But then we walk up to the globe, and if we use a magnifying glass, and globes of the 16th century had tiny print on them, I mean, 3 millimetres high only, so you needed a magnifying glass to look at England. But nevertheless, it was a true representation of the planet. He's now thinking, I want to do this in 2D in a bound volume of maps. So he gets around the problem of dimension by having three different levels of detail. You zoom out, so there's a map of the whole British Isles, England, Scotland, Wales, and all the outlying islands with Ireland. Then you zoom in to this map here, and you just have England and Wales. You zoom in again in this section of 16 maps covering the British Isles, and you can see just East Anglia on its own, the West Country on its own, Northumberland on its own, so you get even more detail. Now, you might notice on this map, they're very faint actually, but I can see them clearly from here, but you can see the meridians, the up-down lines, they're slightly converging, but they do have a grid of measurements on them, so you could actually take a grid reference off this map. And this, if you like, was the... it's not a Mercator projection because you've got the meridians converging. It doesn't, as we've just discussed, if you use Mercator's projection, you kind of distort land area. And this is a stepping stone to what we're now going to see, which is the Ordnance Survey 500 years later, using Mercator's projection to map Britain. So that's the connection between Mercator and modern British maps.
And I love the fact that the gutter of the page here actually isn't far off 2 degrees west.
It's not far off.
Completely
2 degrees west.
By chance.
Yeah, exactly.
Completely by chance. You could have followed the gutter.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's go back to the Ordnance Survey. So this is what I think is wonderful. So to make that connection, that because you go from that map and that's how you end up with the OS. I think that's so wonderful that we're back on Salisbury Plain.
The Ordnance Survey mapped Britain on Mercator's projection. They tweaked it. It's called the transverse Mercator projection. And when you do this for a land area, you have to choose what's called a central meridian. It's like a cartographic spine of a book. Now, they couldn't use Greenwich because it's too far east, which would have meant that, you know, the line of 0 degrees longitude would be lovely and accurate up through East Anglia, but the further west you go, the more distorted the landmass will become. They needed to choose the line of longitude, the meridian that was most central to Britain. Well, 1 degree west runs down through the Isle of Wight, but 2 degrees west hangs like a plumb line from the Scottish border down the middle of Britain and out through the Isle of Purbeck in Dorset. So they chose 2 degrees west, and they drew a straight line down the middle, and then they anchored a grid of 1 kilometre squares to 2 degrees west. So when I was walking the length of England, I was able to do it only because 2 degrees west is the central meridian. And I just stayed within I allowed myself a 2,000 metre kind of invisible dog leash to avoid climbing over too many roofs. and oddly enough, so I did this in 1997 before the age of GPS. So I navigated the entire journey using a handheld compass and a 1 to 25,000 map. Now, for those of you who are keen on mountain walking, you'll know that just an old-fashioned compass and 1 to 25,000 map would allow you to navigate to within 10 metres on the ground. The maps are so accurate. They'll show you, for example, which side of a fence or a hedge a footpath goes. So, But I did have my adventures. You know, there were obstacles. And, you know, the Ordnance Survey is a military mapping agency, or started as a military mapping agency. We know James Wild, the one we started with, effectively a military map. I could only walk 2 degrees west with the help of the Minister of Defence, ironically, because in three places, 2 degrees west crosses MOD land. I had to walk across the middle of RAF Lynham, which is the biggest Hercules RAF station in Britain. So I was escorted early one morning by two RAF sergeants over the main runway. We had to kind of look right, look left, look right again while the planes took off. Which they thought was hilarious. And then I talk about crossing Salisbury Plain, being led by the army. And then when I got to Poole Harbour, which is, you know, a big tidal body of water, I had to go right over the middle of it. And I'd already sailed across a reservoir in the north using a sailing dinghy, but I hadn't got a boat with me to cross Poole Harbour, which is much bigger. So the Royal Marines turned out and ferried me across the far side. So, yeah, a lot of adventures on that trip.
And I love that, in a way, we end with this slide here, which shows actually the restrictions and the dangers that you were talking about, which takes us right back to James Wild. You know, this danger area, the Lark Hall artillery range. I mean, this takes us really back to what was going on in 1872 with you, crazy person, going down 2 degrees west.
It's a fascinating image, this, the one that you've chosen, because it gives the whole story. You know, we've got, as you see, the artillery range and the danger area. That's the legacy from James Wild, because the MOD now own this land. But you also have the surviving public rights of way. Those red dashes are road users' public paths, a public footpath and so on. But you also have a really dense scattering of Bronze Age barrows, tumuli, the Stonehenge is an earthwork crossing the top of the map, and there are field systems on the left. Those are probably Romano-British. When you walk over the plain, as I did with the army, it's a complete paradise. You wouldn't think that a live firing area would be so beautiful, but it's because the army took it over shortly after James Wild drew his map. It's never been deep ploughed by farming. It's only ever been horse ploughed. So a horse plough doesn't go in very deep. It is now a naturalist paradise. I walked across it in August, on a summer's day in August, with the army. There were clouds of butterflies. The wild grasses were thigh high. And contrary to belief, you know, the army really look after it. All the archaeological sites have these kind of dragon's teeth around the outside of them so that tanks don't destroy them. And you know, you're not continually walking over deep ruts left by army vehicles. I was astonished. I thought, well, actually, thank God they did take it over, because actually they preserved what is now the largest surviving area of natural short grassland in Northwest Europe. The actual line, 2 degrees west, is 577 kilometres long. So, of course, with a wiggle factor, you know, I must have walked 700 or 800 kilometres, I guess, by the time I finished the walk. It took over 2 months. There were a large number of sections that weren't covered by public rights of way, on which I frequently met gamekeepers and farmers. our interactions always ended up being fairly cordial. I carried with me as a precaution. We're looking at on the screen here a large scale map of Salisbury Plain, but I carried a small scale map of England at 1 to 250,000, and I'd cut and glued together 2 degrees west out of about 8 or so of these maps. So, and then folded it in a concertina that was about 10 foot long. So when I was sort of interrupted in my kind of daydreams walking over a private estate by a gamekeeper on a quad bike, I could then unfold my concertina and show and every day I'd ink the line progressing down 2 degrees west. It looked fantastic on the concertina, because you would think that's impossible to walk in such a straight line for so many weeks. So the blue line would extend to as far as the latest encounter. So the landowner or gamekeeper or whoever would be able to think, well, am I going to be the one who spoils this? spoils this attempt to describe England objectively? And bless that. So I was never turfed off, actually. And indeed, I frequently ended up, as long as they were on 2 degrees west, in farmhouse kitchens or gamekeepers' cottages, telling stories. My faith in the British population was enormously kind of invigorated by the encounters I had. And of course, if you deliberately follow a transect, actually the stories that you're going to accumulate are going to be way more diverse than if, for example, I'd made a walking tour of British castles, you know. I was as misunderstood as my great hero, Mercator. I'm not going to compare myself to Mercator, but, you know, when the book eventually came to be reviewed, the Daily Mail said that I was a prat, and the Daily Telegraph said that I was a genius. So you can see that I was writing for the Daily Telegraph at the time. You know, possibly I didn't do it, but yeah. So is it kind of, it was misunderstood by some quarters.
Only you could take us from butterflies on Salisbury Plain right back to Mercator's projection in 1569. I just want to say, Nick, thanks so much for joining us on this very special live edition of What's Your Map at the British Library. Thank you. There are lots of past episodes for you to enjoy, to delve into the catalogue, scan the QR code on the screen, or search What's Your Map on the podcast platform of your choice. For me, for now, it's goodbye. Until next time, thank you all for coming. I hope you've enjoyed the day.